And welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Again, check out those swinging sounds. Go to drdrew.com. Please support the people that support us. We appreciate it very, very much. So I get to keep doing these things. I enjoy doing them. I hope you like listening. Tell a friend. We appreciate it. Check out Adam and Dr. Drew. Check out me and the Spaz at the Weekly Infusion. Very interesting show today. Tim Ryan's going to stop by a little later. He's written a book called From Dope to Hope, A Man in Recovery. He's got a lot of real intense experience there in the program. But right now I'm particularly excited to bring in Dr. Janina Scarlett. Her website is superhero-therapy.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Shadow Quill, founder of Superhero Therapy. Dr. Scarlett, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Oh, it's a privilege. And I want to hear all about this. I'm very excited. Dr. Scarlett is also a professor at the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant International University, a place that I've lectured, and I've also worked alongside of the students there, and they've been excellent. And you grew up, so to speak. You got your PhD and your, in psychology and neuroscience from the City University of New York. That is a great program. And tell me about Superhero.
So I was working at Camp Pendleton with active duty Marines with PTSD, and many of them kept stating over and over and over again, I wanted to be Superman, I failed.
Mm-hmm.
So these incredibly courageous men and women believed themselves to be a failure just because they developed a mental health disorder after seeing some of the worst atrocities imaginable. And so this is where my geeky knowledge came in. I've been a self-proclaimed geek since a very early age. So I would question them. I would challenge these thoughts, and I would ask them, does Superman have any vulnerabilities? And, of course, he does. He's vulnerable to kryptonite for once, right? And then I would ask, does this vulnerability make him any less of a superhero? And, of course, the answer is no. So by drawing parallels of people's favorite heroes, not only traditional superheroes, but also characters from fantasy like Harry Potter and science fiction like Star Wars or Star Trek, I've been able to help my patients better understand their own painful, traumatic experiences and fears, as well as to draw from their heroes to help them set a path for recovery.
Well, this is really interesting to me. I just did another podcast, those of you who are regular listeners, with Wes Chapman about this very issue. He was a young man who made it through horrible abuse and was able and was actually fascinated by comic book superheroes. And he has a new program, sort of mobilize the hero, you know, move from victim to hero. And it really does seem to be that the narrative, or having a narrative, is a really important part of recovery from trauma. Would that be accurate?
That's it. Absolutely, that's it. When we are thinking of ourselves as a victim, or when we blame ourselves for what happened to us, we're more likely to be stuck in trauma. Unfortunately, this is really common. A lot of trauma survivors are likely to blame themselves for what occurred. And this is where narrative comes in. This is where we can use evidence-based therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy to help clients challenge these thoughts. But I find that it's easiest to do that with drawing parallels between the client's experience as well as their own personal heroes. So I've actually set out a book, Superhero Therapy. It's the first self-help book for geeks by geeks, so it's part fiction and part nonfiction self-help book. And in it, I have a group of superheroes that are all struggling with some kind of a mental health disorder, and then go through a hero academy where they learn how to manage their symptoms and how to change that narrative, how to change their thinking from victim to survivor, and how to empower themselves through connecting with their hero core values.
And there's a couple other sort of themes that came out in the last hero conversation I had, which was, one is that in order to have hope, or to have a sort of a, let's see, a model for that recovery and walking through that narrative, you need deep connection with another person. Is that part accurate?
Yes. So I find... please go ahead.
Well, I'm wondering if that person has to be a therapist, or can it just even be just somebody that you are trust and open to?
It could be anybody. What we're learning in terms of mental health and healing is that having a close social support, whether it's from a therapist or whether it's from a close friend or maybe from a fandom, can serve as a protective factor either to prevent the development of certain mental illnesses or to help the individual better manage these illnesses. Social support is actually the key number one factor to help individuals be less likely to commit suicide.
I'm fearful when people hear the term social support, they're just going to think friendships and that kind of thing. And I think it's something deeper, no?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This is an individual or group of individuals that people feel like they can be fully honest with. These are individuals that will be likely to support them through anything. These are people that are struggling would be willing to be vulnerable with and open with. And for some people, this can be a fictional character. For some people, they might have this kind of a connection with a fictional character where they might feel like this character gets them, where they might feel like this character is someone for them to look up to, someone that they want to be like, and someone that they can feel maybe this connection with.
When you say you fold in the cognitive behavioral therapy with the cognitive behavioral therapy in with the narrative, how do you do that?
Mm-hmm. So cognitive behavioral therapy has to do with identifying the relationships between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And so, for example, in working on changing our feelings and in working on changing the physical sensations of mind of anxiety, for example, we might introduce mindfulness. And this is where I might talk about the Force from Star Wars and talk about connecting with our internal and external sensations. When we talk about the way that our thoughts might affect our feelings, this is where thought challenging comes in, and this is where a therapist might ask a client, what is the evidence for this thought? Is there another way of looking at it? And what I've been able to do is incorporate the client's beliefs about what their favorite heroes might be going through and draw parallels between those experiences and the client's own experiences. And then finally, what we know is the biggest reason why people are likely to recover, let's say, from depression is changing their behaviors. So by connecting with a heroic character, somebody might be more likely to then engage in activities that bring them joy and more importantly, activities that bring them meaning.
Gina, hold on one second for me, if you can, just one second. I'm wondering if it'd be interesting to bring him in to question her, because I don't know what that experience would be like. Would that screw the structure up of the program? No, it wouldn't work.
No, I was answering your question. No, I don't think that screws up the structure.
Oh, it would be interesting to bring him in?
I think it would be.
Yeah. Do you mind?
He heard the content and stayed to come back and listen, so I don't think he minds at all.
Okay. Janina, I'm taking a little break here because meet Wes Chapman. He's a friend and a guy I've been sort of fascinated by who also came up with the idea of a hero, what should we call it? Hero narrative.
Yeah, I don't know.
And he has been through some heavy trauma and used this kind of thinking as a way of getting through. So I thought it might be interesting to bring him in and let him question you a little bit too, okay?
Fantastic.
Okay, so hold on. So I'm going to set this up. Give me guys a second.
Okay.
We're talking to Dr. Nina Scarlett from the professor at the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant International University. And I just, Dr. Scarlett, noticed that Wes Chapman was still here in this building, and so I asked him to come in. He's the gentleman I was speaking of that had his own experience with a hero narrative, and he happened to hear us talking, and I saw him in the window here. I said, just come on in.
I was literally walking out of the building, and I heard Superman, and I turned around, and I'm like, and what are we talking about?
Which is fascinating to us. Because he and I literally have been sort of sharing ideas about the notion that this something about the hero narrative, hero archetype is sort of needed in our time, and maybe it's because we're all traumatized and it's a way of really managing trauma. And that's what your therapy sort of suggested. And I want to give Wes a chance to sort of ask questions since he's been through it.
Well, first of all, thank you.
Great.
Yeah, thank you so much for the work you're doing. I think there needs to be more conversations like this. So how...
Thank you so much.
How does the dialogue go, and where's the receptiveness happen for this? Is it, you know, 8 to 16, 16 to 20, 20 to 30? Like, where do you find the most receptiveness in age groups?
I love that question. So for me, it actually started with working with active duty Marines, most of which range somewhere between 20 to 30 years of age. I now incorporate it with civilians as well, anywhere between 11 and through 18, as well as with adults.
Is there one age group an age group that's more receptive than others?
So far, it does seem like teens and young adults tend to do really well with it. However, I do see a lot of adults in their 40s, for example, who really like traditional superheroes as well as Star Wars and Star Trek and really benefit from these narratives too. So the groups that I've had, I guess, the most reach with have been teens and young adults, but I've also been able to use it with older adults as well.
And is it the iconic superheroes, the Supermans, the Spider-Mans, the Iron-Mans? What are you finding? Is it the narrative or is it the actual character?
So I've actually been able to use a number of different characters. So superhero therapy refers to using any kind of pop culture characters, from traditional superheroes to characters from science fiction and fantasy.
In other words, do you craft it for a given individual? Like, what do
right,
you like?
Yeah.
Or is it just the hero concept in general that you're selling to them, so to speak, and that they're then forming it into a specific character? How do you do that?
So most of the time at the end of the evaluation session, after I've gotten an idea of what the person might have struggled with, I usually ask them if they have any interests, such as pop culture, if they like any particular characters. And if they do, then usually that's what we might pursue.
And is any particular iconic?
Is there a hero among the heroes?
Yeah, is there one that sort of hits home more than others?
Honestly, no. I've seen a success with a wide variety of characters. Probably one of my most successful therapies to date has been with Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That's random.
I use her a lot in treating women primarily who have survived sexual assault. Mm-hmm.
That was my next, is how much analytical data are you capturing based, like, what superhero offsets what trauma, right?
We have Buffy for women with sexual trauma.
Right, right.
Makes sense, right?
Are you capturing that data?
Not necessarily, I guess not in the way that someone like Dr. Patrick O'Connor, for example, who started Comixpedia, he's a psychologist that actually started documenting different kinds of comic books specifically that might be good for different disorders. I'm not quite as organized as he is in that way, but what I do is I would assess a client for both their interest and their story, and then I try to make a match. I have in the past used characters that clients haven't heard of, like, or haven't had a lot of experience with, like Batgirl, because it was relevant, for example, for service members with disabilities, service members who lost function. Talking about Batgirl after she was shot by the Joker and lost mobility has been really powerful in therapy. And Gail Simone actually donated a bunch of signed books to my clients.
That's amazing. You're diving deep into the comics to find that.
Geek.
Yeah,
she's
you're
a geek.
You're geeking out. I love this. We could talk for hours on this one.
Thank you.
So pushback. What is the community of
psychology
doing, or are they embracing this? Where are you finding that?
You know, I've been so fortunate. In years of doing this, I have not received a lot of pushback. I've actually a lot of psychologists have been meeting me with arms wide open. I'm doing presentations at this point weekly in different centers, providing trainings. In the fall, I will be doing my first workshop in San Diego, training therapists how to do this. So I've actually been receiving a lot of support for this, and I've been able to teach a course at CSPP at Alliance University on this, on how to incorporate pop culture into therapy. And a lot of my students have been able to report an improved rapport as well as improved treatment outcomes.
Are there other aspects of pop culture that you're bringing in?
Yes. I'm incorporating Star Wars, for example, Harry Potter. I'm looking at phobias. I'm looking at depression. I do specialize in trauma, so that's my primary theme. But I have incorporated these other themes as well.
May I ask a personal question? Are you a trauma survivor?
Please. Yes, I am. Yeah. And that's actually in
part of the motivation.
On my website, and it's in my book.
But I've noticed that for trauma survivors, this speaks vividly to them. These narratives.
Going even a step deeper on that, I get very vulnerable and personal. So if I ask this and you don't answer, that's fine, and they can edit this out. But was there others in your close network?
Well, that's where I wanted to go next.
Were there others, brothers, sisters
that you couldn't save?
That you couldn't save?
Yeah, because you didn't. You talked about wanting to see. She opened with that she was dealing with military guys that wanted to be Superman but couldn't. And then I thought to myself, was it also they couldn't save their band of brothers?
Right.
So go ahead. You answer. You answer about yourself and then answer as it pertains to the clinical setting.
Sure. Starting out about my trauma, you mean?
The question – Wes has put a lot of emphasis, and it really spoke to me, on the idea that every great heroic story has somebody you couldn't save. You know, there's always and so he's asking you, was there somebody in your life that you also – you know, was also, you know, hit in the shrapnel of all this?
Or someone, you know, even the – I don't know what your trauma – mine was sexual abuse, and my biological mother was kind of protecting – the abuser and, you know, all that fun stuff. So there's always someone that you couldn't reach, someone that you couldn't pull out. So I'm just curious if that
sibling,
was your...
His siblings could never be rescued. So.
And my three younger siblings were not rescued. So to me, that's – with the work that I do now, that's a massive piece of the motivation. So I'm curious.
And I'm wondering if your veterans also, you know, if they focused more on, I couldn't save myself or I couldn't save my band of brothers, and then you answer about your own history. Go ahead.
Right. Right, absolutely. Well, for me, my family and I I was born and raised in Ukraine. That's where my family and I are from. And so when I was three, we were exposed to massive amounts of radiation from Chernobyl. And that completely destroyed my health. And to this day, I struggle with severe, often life-threatening health issues. And when I moved to the United States, when my family and I moved to the United States, we came here as refugees to escape religious persecution. And when we immigrated here, I was the odd girl. I was the one that came from radiation-exposed country. I was bullied. I was called a freak. And most of the time, I just wanted to die. I felt really alone. I couldn't connect with anybody until I saw the X-Men. And
oh,
that
my.
Was my.
You got superpowers from the radiation.
Yeah, now you
got it.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
And so I saw myself on the screen. I saw mutants like me that were also affected by radiation. And Storm, like me, has a connection with the weather.
Right.
And while I can't control the weather actually is what causes most of my health issues. But I felt really connected to her, and I felt really moved by her origin story and her trauma survival and what she'd been through and her ability to overcome her claustrophobia.
So were there,
and for me, the person...
With your family, how many siblings did you have?
I have a brother, and he's in New York, and thankfully he's doing well. But for me, the person I felt like I couldn't save was my dad.
Yep.
A couple of years ago, he attempted suicide. Mm. And thankfully, he survived. But to me, it felt like it happened on my watch, even though clearly I'm his daughter and not his therapist, but it felt like I overlooked something.
You've got the superpower, and you couldn't help the one that you love the most standing closest to you.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Do you like find, I didn't see something.
Now, do you find those kinds of elements in your patients' stories as well?
I do. I do. And I find that for my patients, what tends to be especially traumatizing, not so much the experience itself, but how alone they feel.
Well, I was just going to say that I have a feeling, talking to both of you guys, that the feeling of I couldn't save myself is too shattering for humans to tolerate. So we'd rather externalize that
to something else
by focusing on the people that we wish we could have saved, because that we can tolerate even though it's overwhelmingly painful.
Well, and the other thing about all of this is that through these superhero narratives, it creates the I'm being heard. You know, so even yours with the X-Men, right? It's like they are hearing you even though they're a fictional character. They can relate.
Exactly.
They're hearing you. They're your story. Same thing for me with – I had several different moments, but Iron Man is kind of my thing of that. Mm-hmm. But
was that in the comic book or with the movie?
Comic book, yeah. I mean, I was reading comics. The movie's awesome. I love it. But for me, it was just understanding the journey of that particular individual and Tony and everything. But, you know, Spider-Man was there and Superman was there. There's all these different narratives. But and the X-Men were insane because I was always the weird kid. And I find that – and this was my next follow-up question to you is, do you find certain – which obviously the answer I'm pretty assuming, but I want you to explain it a little bit, is that there are certain characters, there are certain narratives, there are certain comics like the X-Men that their overarching story relates directly to those that are being bullied. And then you kind of said that with Batgirl, you know, different things, and then with Buffy, which is – that blew my mind. I didn't even think about that with sexual abuse. So,
But you mean the hero when they're in their civilian clothes is being bullied, or they help the bully.
I'm asking if you see someone coming and they start telling their narrative of being bullied and going through those experiences, you are now at this point where you're like, okay, X-Men, that's going to be the narrative. Let me see where their pop culture experience is, who they like. And do you find that in your head you're saying X-Men, and then when you do the discovery, they open up and say X-Men? Are you finding that you're kind of already calling it before they even open their mouth based on where you're at? Does that make sense?
Not necessarily. I find this common theme of being excluded in almost every element of pop culture. So whether it's X-Men, whether it's Harry Potter, you know, I think that there's a lot to pull from in terms of characters that have been bullied and excommunicated or just shunned for being who they are.
Right.
And I've used examples, and I'm not the only therapist that has done this, that have used examples of Harry Potter to help people embrace their sexual identity in terms of,
that's interesting.
You know, in terms of embracing the magical you. There's even a case study published on this topic.
Yeah, I remember, I was thinking of my own therapy, and I remember at certain points, I was sort of trying to – I was aware that I was trying to make a cohesive narrative that I could own of my life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, make it mine. At points where it is sort of nonsensical or shattering or overwhelming, I can see where some kind of externalized narrative
–
again, much like we talked last episode about the swimming to the island thing.
Yeah.
That's a perfect analogy, I think. You want to say it again just so Janina hears it?
Yeah, it's this idea that, you know, hope is a misused word. I'm big into understanding the power of words and the words that we use. And a lot of people will say, I hope somebody can help me. I hope somebody will save me. And hope has been kind of put into this position of you're in a burning building and you hope a fireman comes and saves you.
It's wish, not hope.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hope to me, in the definition that I use and talk about, is it's the understanding that someone has come before you and you can visually see their journey, their narrative, and you can put yourself in that and understand that you can process through it. So I use this.
And we kind of built it out too and started saying, and maybe even somebody can assist you in that journey.
Right. And so the analogy is you're running through the forest is life, and you run up against a lake, right? And that would be the trauma, or that would be the issue, or the narrative you tell yourself of,
or
I
the
can't,
mental illness or whatever.
Right, exactly. And then as you're standing there for 10 years, you you start seeing people.
Well, first you're wishing for the boat.
Right, you're wishing for the boat.
Every day for a boat. Wishing right, every day. Where's the boat? Where's the boat? Where's the boat?
Out in the lake, you see this island.
I'm hoping for a boat.
Yes. Out in the lake, you see this island, and there's a party going on, which is what you want in your life, when the party can represent anything.
You want to get to the island.
You want to get to that island, and you stand there waiting for the boat, and then you start witnessing these people jumping in and swimming and then living this amazing life, and it's a choice you make of, do I trust them? Do I follow them? Is someone going to help me, not save me? Is someone going to assist me, maybe give me the tools, whatever it might be? So that's the island analogy very quickly. But
it fits, right? It's good.
I'm very fascinated by the brand that you're building, and Dr. Drew and I have had many conversations that this country, this world is in need of hero. Every hero we're talking about has been created in these fictional lands, these fictional experiences. We're fascinated by them. We have been since the dawn of humanity. We can say religion is somehow a fantasy. We're not going to get down that rabbit hole. But I believe that now is a time that these individuals like yourself, you're becoming a narrative of a hero.
Yeah.
Your story, I mean, amazing of where you're coming with where you've come from. And I think now we have the ability to create story through more people, through more human beings that are being heroes, instead of only relying on the narrative of Iron Man and Superman. I love it.
I'm sighing a little bit because, A, yes, but we need to mobilize people to do
right.
that. And I'm thinking about how, you know, so many kids, young Americans, were connected to superhero stories through most of the 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe 60s.
Well, and she's talking about 40-year-olds.
Even 20s, 30s, 40s.
Yeah.
But we've disconnected from
100%.
That. 100%. Yeah, we're disconnected from everything. We're disconnected from the basic ideas and principles of this country and what used to be the idea of America. We're disconnected from superheroes. We're disconnected from our – we're just disconnected, and we need to reconnect. But – Dr. Scarlett, I have to wrap it up. Is there anything else you'd like people to know before we end this little interesting conversation?
No, I think that's it. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I suspect Wes may be calling you to pick your brain a little more.
We need to pick brain, and I would love to know what you're doing. With training,
how you can operationalize some of this.
Operationalize it.
Wes, I've been having off mic conversations about this. There's something here. There's something about it. And it's particularly traumatized individuals, as you're finding, whether it's veterans or childhood sexual abuse, whatever it might be. It really is something they can grab onto. It's more than a life preserver. You still there?
Thank you.
All right. And
thank you so much for having me.
You got it. And we'll look for you at the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant University. And Wes, you can follow him at weschapman.com. And we're going to come back with Tim Ryan. Just take a little break.
Hey, I want to remind you guys about our friend at Alliant University. One of the most really rewarding parts of working in recovery is seeing former patients successfully move on. And some of them will walk up to me years later and they have a degree in psychology or they're professional in something. And addicts are phenomenal people, and when they get their disease in remission, they can do great things. And, of course, the field of psychology is big, and it needs competent practitioners. There's a lot of opportunity there. And if you're considering it, I suggest you consider the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant University. I've known these guys for a long time now at Alliant, and I'm proud to have spoken at their past events. It was founded in 1969. It has an alumni network of nearly 50,000 people. I've worked alongside of these individuals during their clinical years. CSPP at Alliant University hosts both on- and off-ground programs in business psychology, marriage and family therapy, clinical psychology. They have APA-accredited doctoral programs in clinical psychology that allow specialization in child, clinical, forensic, and integrated psychologies. Their faculty is made up of really legends: Abraham Maslow, Carl Rogers, Viktor Frankl, some of the fathers of psychology. So for more information on the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant, click the Alliant banner on my site, drdrew.com, or just visit Alliant, A-L-L-I-A-N-T, alliant.edu. That is alliant.edu. Hey, I do want to take a quick moment just to remind everybody about our friends at TrueCar. They cannot just they're not just a place you can buy new cars. You can be like Chris Maxipad and get a used car as well, a pre-owned vehicle. Over 70,000 pre-owned vehicles from the over 13,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. So whether you're looking to buy new or used, get that upfront pricing, you see the scattergram of what's being paid for that particular car you're interested in your area. You'll learn a ton about that car on True Car and the True Car app as well. You also can get discounts off the list price that you can't get anywhere else and a better buying experience. So see what others paid for the car you want, then get that fair price, connect with a local certified dealer, and when you go, you'll be confident because the price you've locked in is for actual inventory for that in that dealer's lot. So an actual car there, it's not some possible car. That car is on the lot and you've locked in the price and you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. So when you're ready to buy new or used, visit True Car. Some features are not available in all states.
Blinds galore. Yes, they are my friends. We just got our blinds today, quite literally, and they do one thing and they do it better than anyone. They create 100% custom window treatments built to your exact measurements down to every detail, and they've covered over 2 million windows and counting. Now, they not only give you exactly what you ask, but you don't have to go to the stress of going out to a store when you can do everything at blindsgalore.com right from home. And from start to finish, measuring, picking out the right window covering, insulating, they have their experts there that will help guide you every step of the way. I mean it. They are extremely helpful. And as I said, we just got our blinds today. Blinds Galore will even set you up with free samples, free shipping on top of the free expertise. We had that. We held up all the different samples to make sure they were exactly what we wanted. Blinds Galore makes it easy to get the designer blinds and shades you've always wanted without the designer price tag, especially with their 4th of July sale. Go check out blindsgalore.com and let them know Dr. Drew sent you. That is blindsgalore.com.
Well, the rising cost of prescription medication is no joking matter. It concerns me not just as a doctor, but as a patient. That's right. Listen, I have to take a bunch of medications for my cholesterol and having prostate cancer and whatnot, and my blood pressure. But even with good insurance, the price of medication has become a big concern for most of us. I know, geez, when I see the actual price of the medication as well as what I have to pay, I'm stunned. Every time I have a prescription refilled, and with patients, they complain, I have to worry about it. It's an issue. Well, let me introduce you to RefillWise, RefillWise, a prescription saving card that you can get on your phone right now for free. No sign up, no wait time. Save on your next prescription. Simply use your mobile phone. Text Drew, D-R-E-W, to the number 22822. Again, that's Drew to 22822, and you will immediately receive your RefillWise prescription savings card ready to use. Just show it to your pharmacist and see how much you can save for your prescriptions. It works with major pharmaceutical companies to establish discounts on the price of over 6,000 commonly used medication. Right now, more than 1 million people are using this card. The average savings, 40% and some up to 80%. I use it. So you have medication not covered by insurance, make sure to check the RefillWise price at your pharmacy. Even if you have insurance, the RefillWise discount might actually be bigger, so it always pays to check before you check out. Also, I'm thrilled that for every new user, RefillWise will donate $1 to the Prostate Cancer Foundation, a charity that is very dear to my heart. Check them out at pcf.org. To learn more about RefillWise and see if your medication could be covered, check out refillwise.com. But to start saving right now, just text DREW, that's Drew, to the number 22822. Again, that's 22822. Message and data rates may apply.
And welcome back. Thank you, Dr. Nina Scarlett and Wes Chapman. Now we're going out to Tim Ryan. The book is From Dope to Hope, A Man in Recovery. It's available now on Amazon. Do check it out. His story is phenomenal, and it is the real deal. TimRyan.com. Also follow him on Twitter, at A Man in Recovery. Let's keep going through your stuff, Tim. All right, you ready?
I'm ready.
AMIRF.org, A Man in Recovery Foundation. Tell us about that.
Man in Recovery Foundation, I set up actually when I was incarcerated. I wrote the business plan, and we guide and direct people into treatment, people that have no insurance, state insurance, good insurance, and all the funds we raise, we use to pay for indigent people to get into long-term programs, four-month big book boot camps, and then we'll pay for people to get into sober homes.
Wait a minute. I think I may have got your book wrong. Did I do that? It's booktimryan.com. Is that the website?
Book, yeah. If you can go to my website for speaking events, it's booktimryan.com, but the foundation is amirf.org.
And you said you founded it as you came out of prison or while you were in prison?
Well, I wrote the business plan for the foundation in prison, and it's crazy. I was doing a 12-step meeting the other day, and my former sponsor hands me a letter, and he said, I want you to read this. This was a letter 4 years ago I wrote him why I was incarcerated. And in that letter, I said, you know, I wrote this business plan for this foundation I'm going to set up, and here we are 4 years later with the Man in Recovery Foundation and published a book and doing podcasts with you, and my life doesn't suck.
Talk to him about the some of that road to recovery and what happened.
You know, long story short, I struggled with addiction my whole life. I was a kid with ADD, learning disabilities, dyslexia. I was in all the slow classes, and I found drugs and alcohol at a very young age. And at 21 was my first time in treatment, and they said, you know, go to meetings and work the steps. Well, I always like to play my own God, and I like to sponsor myself. So, you know, the cycle, I was in and out, and I'd been over a year sober, not working a program. I thought I could go to meetings and get sober through osmosis, and I took a guy to Chicago to move out of his apartment, and his roommate was doing heroin. He said, you want to try some? And I tried one bag, and that took me down a 12-year road to utter hell and destruction. Two stints in prison. My last stint, December 16th of 2010, I overdosed while driving. I hit two cars. I put four people in the hospital, one being a nine-month-old baby. I fought the case for 21 months. In the midst of fighting the case, my then 17-year-old son and I started doing heroin together. That's how Nick and I bonded. I was ultimately sentenced to 7 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections on October 30th of 2012. I did 13 and a half months in prison. I was at a place called Sheridan Correctional Center outside of Chicago, and they run the West Care Drug Treatment Program in there, and that's where I really plugged into recovery. I truly surrendered, studied the big book, the NA Basic Text, the Bible, read hundreds of books, wrote my business plan. But in prison, my oldest son was in active addiction. My wife divorced me. We lost our beautiful house in foreclosure, all due to me. I caused all of this. And then when I got out, I set up my foundation. I ultimately stumbled into working in the treatment space, but on my 21-month sobriety date, my 20-year-old son, Nicholas, succumbed to a heroin overdose. So actually, heroin and benzos. He had started two bags of heroin and ate a bar of Xanax, started overdosing. His friends knew it. They panicked. They didn't call 911. They propped him on the sofa, went in the basement, did more drugs, came up, forgot about him, and Nick was dead. Since my son died August 1st of 2014, last Thursday night, I attended my 108th funeral in 2.5 years. Yeah, you know, I'm sick and tired of burying people. And you know, with this, with heroin and opiates, you don't have time to hit a bottom. You die.
Yeah,
it's heart-wrenching, and you know, we've seen what happens. Our friend we did that intervention with on the Steve Harvey show, I mean, he's still out there struggling, you know. It's yeah. Heart-wrenching, but there is hope. There's a lot of people out there turning their lives around, and I'm trying to, I'm the guy that's in the trenches, going into the homes, doing interventions, getting people into treatment. I don't care if they have insurance, none. Good insurance and doing what we can do to try to get them on the road to recovery.
Are you seeing what I'm seeing with the opiate deaths? It's either fentanyl, sort of inadvertent, or some combination of opiate benzodiazepine.
At 100%, I was. They just had a big bust up in my hometown, Crystal Lake, Illinois. 7.5 pounds of heroin, and it's predominantly fentanyl. Fentanyl's everywhere. The carfentanil, the different analogs, and a lot of these kids today they're mixing benzos, or they think they're taking benzos, and it's actually pressed fentanyl.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Well, the benzo thing, I mean, we have Chris Cornell died now because of a fentanyl-related phenomenon, and we're not quite sure what but I'm certain the lorazepam figured into it. I mean, a long-term opiate addict in recovery should not be on that medicine. It will have adverse effect. We have Prince, Xanax, fentanyl. We have every patient I can think of that's died in the last 10 years.
Today, I just read Paul O'Neill from the Trans-Siberian Orchestra just died from a prescription drug overdose.
And it's got to be the combo, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and what blows my doors off is, you know, everyone's pushing maintenance, methadone, Suboxone, you know, and not that I'm accepting it, but if more doctors actually treated people and had them on that for 30 days and put them on Vivitrol or whatever, I'd be more supportive. But they're just putting them on these things, and then they're abusing Xanax or these other variables.
Right.
Or these doctors are giving them benzodiazepines.
Yes.
Why they're on it? It's ludicrous.
Yes, it's wild. I'm doing Good Morning America shortly, and they asked me this question. They go, well, why are doctors doing this? I said, I don't have an answer. I can't. It's still a bias from the '90s when pain was the fifth vital signs and pain control was whatever the patient said it was.
The whole JACO chart. And, you know, it's interesting. I just spoke at a hospital 2 weeks ago with the coroner and myself for the keynotes. And there were 65 emergency room doctors, nurse practitioners, people on the chemical dependency unit. And I understand from the emergency room standpoint, get them in, get them out. They're seeing the same people coming through the ER every week, every other week. Oh, Donnie overdosed again, and they're getting them fixed up, and they're shooting them right out the door. I said, you know, we've got to get laws changed where if someone's brought to a hospital due to an overdose, they're remanded to treatment on the spot, no questions asked. They would have just died, but they're sending them out, and then they're getting more bends. So it's mind-boggling, and when is it going to stop? I don't know when it's going to stop, but we're just putting a Band-Aid on it.
Yeah, I know. And listen, I'm sort of looking at the history of this stuff. And the last big opioid epidemic was at the end of the 19th century. It was all post-Civil War stuff. And we discovered morphine and we thought we had the Holy Grail to help end human suffering and pain. And lo and behold, this epidemic opened up and it was, again, physician-mediated. And they really had kind of this weird fatalistic attitude back then, which was like, well, we got to get doctors to stop prescribing it, and all these drug addicts are just going to die off. So anyway, and that's really what they did. And my fear is that we're kind of all the replacement stuff is a similar sort of modality. Am I wrong?
I absolutely agree because they're not putting enough education into it. And everybody's jumping on the maintenance bandwagon, and I'm not saying I wouldn't support it because I'm sick of burying people, but these doctors are uneducated to where they're not making sure someone's on it. They're not drug testing them to make
sure
they're
they
not.
They may be drug testing, but they're only testing them for opiates, which
no,
is, to me is
to
laughable.
They're testing for cocaine, benzos, MDMA, alcohol. And make sure they're getting some type of treatment, and they have a plan to get them off it.
Yes,
I mean,
sir.
And that's what I see is not happening.
Yep.
Some places are trying, but it's so far and few between. And what else is happening? I mean, these people that can't afford insurance, or I'll take Illinois where I live. If you have state insurance, it's a 6 to 12 week wait to get a bed. You're not going to wait. You're going to die.
It's just so it kills me. I don't know what to – I feel overwhelmed whenever I talk about this topic. And there's very few psychiatric beds around. We have a deficiency in the numbers of psychiatrists.
Awful.
Yeah. And then the ability to access quality care for opiate addiction is sort of all being shifted to the outpatient setting. I mean, we have these outpatient physicians out there being encouraged to prescribe Suboxone. 250 patients on Suboxone any given individual can have. I'm an expert in opiate addiction. I would not have more than 20. I couldn't handle it.
How do you manage it?
You can't. You can't. That's being a supplier. That's straight up supplying.
Well, Dr. Drew, if you really look at it, who's pushing this? Big Pharma. I mean, you look at the company
I know. That's the part. Everyone wants to blame the OxyContin manufacturer. I'm telling you, the evil part of this story is the Suboxone manufacturer who developed this with the government.
Right.
Alongside the government, and the government has pushed back their what do they call it? The generics. You can't make generics of that drug because the government is giving that company an exception to extend it.
Well, that's why they went from the pill to the film.
That's exactly right. That's exactly why.
You know, and you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure it out, but the problem is
it's gravely concerning.
So many parents too. They go on Google, they read in all these Facebook groups, and they don't do their due diligence. See, where I pick up a lot of the pieces, a lot of the people that are on state insurance, or I went and visited a treatment center today that uses methadone, and I said, all right, so you're sending a client out of here on 60 milligrams of methadone. What are you going to do when they can't afford to pay for that at the clinic anymore? Then they're going to run out, and they're calling me up saying, I'm going to kill myself because I can't get them in anywhere to detox unless they're 25 milligrams or less. They go right back to doing heroin, and they die.
Yeah.
So we're setting people up to fail. We're absolutely setting people up to fail.
Yeah, it's a very disheartening situation for the opiate addicts. And let's keep in mind that it's my profession that has largely brought this upon us. Well, and to be fair, it really wasn't my profession. It was attorneys and patient advocacy groups that started fining and putting physicians in prison for elder abuse and inadequate treatment of pain. Literally in Florida and California, there are cases where it sent traumatic waves, shivers down the spine of every physician, which is when people started just referring to pain management doctors. And
right.
Pain became the fifth vital sign, and doctors just rolled over. And then there was an entire generation that came along that was trained to do this, and they're still around, and they don't see another way of doing it.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I thought, are you familiar with Dr. Gabor Mate?
Oh, of course, in Canada.
I saw that gentleman speak 3-4 months ago at a big conference in Chicago, and he rocked my world because there's about 300 clinicians there, and I'm one of three people that's not a clinician. I have no clinical background. I'm a street drug addict. I'm a successful businessman, and I know how to put the pieces together, but I am not a clinician. And he gets up there, and the first thing he says is, look, I don't ask people why the addiction. I ask them why the pain. And it's all some form of trauma. And then he says, then the disease kicks in. But what really shocked me was out of these 300 clinicians, he said, how many of you are trauma certified? Maybe 20 people put their hands up. He said, there's the problem because you're working on the substance abuse, but you're not getting to the underlying issues. You're peeling these clients open, and they get out, and they're going right back to what they know because they don't know how to deal with the emotion.
Well, let me tell you two interesting corollaries to that. One is California, we were required to do these pain management seminars. This is back in the day when we had to be encouraged to treat pain more aggressively. We weren't treating pain aggressively enough, and so I was at a conference. And the head of the pain management program gets up and goes, hey, funny thing about chronic pain patient. Funny thing, 97% of them have a history of physical or sexual abuse. Anyway, let me tell you about methadone. It's like, what? I was like, what?
Right,
what? I was shocked. And it was never mentioned again in the entire conference. Then, but here's an interesting twist on the whole thing, on Gabor's point, which is that you can't treat the trauma until someone has been sober 6 to 12 months.
I agree.
And so you have to treat the addiction aggressively first. To have a complete recovery, you have to treat the trauma. I totally agree with him. And how you treat it and when you treat it is a little bit of an art.
So, and I agree. Now, the people that are addicts in that, probably 95% of them. But here's the problem. How many of those people have the funds or the resources to go through the full treatment program and then get the proper trauma therapy or mental health or whatever? It's just not out there. It's not in Illinois.
Less than 2 or 3%, I bet, if that. And then remind ourselves that, you know, trauma survivors are unmotivated to address trauma. Their brain tells them, no, you're fine. And so you have to get them motivated. You have to have a team of people working on it.
You absolutely do. And you know, I just had a mother come meet with me last Thursday. Her son Ryan died probably 2 months ago. I've known him for 3 years. Great kid. Treatment a number of times. And this kid never did heroin. The first time he tried heroin, about 5 months sober, it killed him. But she's like, Tim, what do I do now? And I said, well, two things are going to happen. I said, you're going to take this negative and turn it into a positive, or you're going to live in grief and unfortunately live through your dead son for the rest of your life. I see it happen. And she said, what do we do? And I said, I think it's time for me to start some type of grief support group to where these parents can get together. But how can they move forward? Because I see some that really get involved and want to help with my foundation or do this. But then I see other ones that want to blame and ask why. And I tell parents that there is no why. You know, God, if you believe in a God, God called them home, their work's over, it's a disease, whatever reason, but don't ask why, because that mental masturbation will destroy you.
Yeah, the why is because they had a fatal illness. And people,
exactly.
People cannot get their head around that, number one. Number two, I'm seeing all these sort of untreated codependents wanting to save the world now, and they're going all different directions. I would urge any of those parents to get deeply involved in Al-Anon or a program
yep.
like that and help one other survivor or parent of a survivor at a time, or of a non-survivor.
Right.
And then maybe you get a group together that can begin to form something that can begin to grow in an organic way. But at this point, the primary way to help is to heal yourself and then help others heal.
I agree.
This business of we're going to form a foundation and end addiction.
No. And I tell them, I tell them, don't do it. You can help my foundation. Everyone starts one. I said, get it into this space, whether you did it because you lost a loved one or you're sober now, is like the sport of skydiving. It's about 3 years, you get burned out, and you move on. I said, people think I've got this glamorous life. I do podcasts. I'm on the TV. I've wrote books. I said, you would not want to walk through the hell I've had to walk through, deal with the mothers that are calling me saying, Tim, my son just died, the hysterical phone calls. You don't want my job. This is not one that is easy. And for me, my recovery has got to be number one. My therapist, everything, because I can't function. It's interesting because I put a comment on one of my Facebook groups the other day saying, look, being an advocate is not being in recovery. They're two totally separate things. And I see so many people trying to everyone's got a story, but just because you have a story doesn't mean you're good at carrying a message or you're offering the right tools. And I just had a friend of mine that was doing a bunch of speaking events with all these old reality TV stars. And I said, you need to quit doing that. That's all ego. They're not even in the recovery space, and it's going to deflate you. 3 weeks later, he went and relapsed. And what he tells me is, he said, Tim, I never worked a 12-step-based program. Well, what in the heck are you doing trying to carry a message? You can't transmit something you don't have.
Yeah, that's always concerning and enraging when I hear those kinds of stories. But the other thing is, you cannot, if you're going to try to help other people, you cannot go it alone. Or even just in your little sort of comment about helping other people, you mentioned your therapist, your recovery community. You've got to have a team. You got to have a team behind you, because it ain't something, that disease will just take everybody down. It takes everybody with it.
It absolutely will. And I see it happen time and time again. And I've actually pulled back, and I don't want to get crazy and expand, because I had some people that were working with me that ultimately relapsed. And it's like, look, this going out and helping people is wonderful, but if you're not keeping your own recovery first, you're dead in the water, and you will use. And I see it time and time again.
The other thing about helping other people, you have to really be sure your recovery is where it needs to be. And it's funny, my partner at Chemical Dependence Unit I worked at for many years, I was after him for a long time to come. I needed another medical doctor on the team. And when I went after him, he'd been sober. He's a physician, been sober like 5 years. And he went back and he goes, hang on, I've got to ask my sponsor, the director of my diversion program. He had like three or four different people he had to check in with to see if it's okay for me to do this. And for the first 3 years of me asking, I'd ask every year, they'd go, no, you're not ready. And he'd go, I'm sorry, my team's and fall. And all of a sudden, about year four, he goes, okay. And I thought, well, what changed? He goes, I don't know. They say I'm ready now. It's like, okay, let's go. So, you cannot use your brain to assess your recovery if it's putting it in harm's way or under stress. You got to have your little team assess you.
Well, what else I see too, even with a lot of the treatment centers out there, there's a lot of people in it and they think they're helping, but the owner, they're not in recovery, or they don't have a background with you, and it ultimately turns into money. And I'm all, hey, it's okay to make money, but client care has got to be number one. And when that starts getting shifted, forget it, you're with the wrong place, or And there's just so many. I mean, there's some great facilities out there, but there are some really some bogus ones too. But
Where do you refer people? I've started referring to Hazelden programs. Where else do you refer?
So I when I left my former company, I went and interviewed. When word got on the street, I was available. I had 11 job offers in 36 hours. So I traveled the country and looked at a number of places. And I went to a very small facility in Palm Beach, Florida, called the Recovery Team. They've been in business 22 years. They do a ton of trauma, first responders program. It's a 50-unit, that's it, PHP, ILP, inpatient, 90-day continuum of care. We have a facility in Bloomington, Indiana, one in Philadelphia. But it could be, I use other places for high-end trauma, bipolar, the refuge in Florida. There's some places in California. It really just depends. Even though I work for a treatment center, 98% of the people do not go there. Mm. They're just not the fit. And it's not for me. I'll call my friend Suzette, who's a clinical director, all this stuff, and, okay, where do we go with this person? And she'll do a biopsychosocial and say, here's the two places that I recommend. And but then again, when the families don't have the good resources, you have to work with what's
that's
available.
Right. That's right. And that's more often than not what you're doing. You're just struggling to find a bed somewhere.
Exactly. Then,
but it is something that you shouldn't just Google. You should really ask for professional guidance. A Man of Recovery Foundation, AMIRF.org is where Tim is. You can get his book, From Dope to Hope, A Man of Recovery. Would you want people in early recovery to read the book, or parents, or just everybody?
I'm telling you, this book is – I've got 12-year-olds reading this. Parents that have had a son or daughter struggling, they're giving this to their kids. This book, I've had a lot of parents reach out to me, and people can go to Amazon and look at Dope Dope Tim Ryan, but read the reviews. It gives a lot of parents perspective. Now I know why my child, my husband, my wife does what they do, because they didn't understand. And I give the full gamut of what all I did was wear masks in my entire self-centered world was driven around addiction. But this is good for anybody. People that are sober, people that have someone struggling, believe me, it's a quick read. You can read it 5-6 hours, but it's very powerful. And at the end of it, there's hope, and that's all that matters.
All right, my friend. It's good to talk to you as always.
Hey, it's good
and
to talk to you.
Best of luck with the book and with the Man of Recovery Foundation and your recovery and those that you're desperately trying to help. I really appreciate it, Tim. We'll talk soon.
Bye, Dr. Chu. Have a blessed day, my brother. Bye-bye.
That's it. We appreciate you guys. And again, thank you for supporting the show and supporting the people who support this. If you go to drchu.com, we have other resources for referrals for addiction treatment. The American Addiction Foundation, am I getting that right? I think that's also there on the website if you want to check that out. And I'll just see you next time. We'll see you then.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com.
Justin, and so good. Thousands of spring deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save big today on new arrivals from Kate Spade New York, Nike, Sam Edelman, Free People, and Madewell, starting at only $30. Great brands and great prices on dresses, denim, sandals, designer bags, and more. So rack your look and get first dibs on spring styles you want now from just $30 at your Nordstrom Rack store. What will you find?
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.